You're tuned to hour number three of this week's Blues Before Sunrise. I'm your host, Steve Cushing. During the next hour, we'll be presenting an interview with Robert M. W. Dixon, one of the co-compilers of the book Blues and Gospel Records 1890 to 1943, which is currently in its fourth edition. This pre-war blues discography lists all the blues and gospel records made from the very first recordings, which were done in 1890, covers the years up till 1943, and the World War recording ban, which took place starting in August of 1942 due to a material shortage, not enough shellac. This discography lists every recording by every artist. It provides the artist, the name of the tune recorded, the date, label, and serial number, and location, as well as the personnel and their instruments playing on every tune. This interview with Dr. Dixon was conducted by phone on September 2, 2009, for my book Pioneers of the Blues Revival. The interview was recorded, as you'll hear it, with almost no edits. If you have a copy of the book, Pioneers of the Blues Revival, it may help to read along. The interview with Dr. Dixon starts on page 121. And this is our interview with Dr. Robert M. W. Dixon.
It's Robert M. W. on the books, but everyone calls me Bob, so it's Bob Dixon.
Can you tell me when and where you were born?
Yeah, okay. Well, I was born in Gloucester, in the UK, of course, on the 25th of January, 1939. And I was brought up for the first few years in Stroud, a little town in the Cotswolds. And at the age of eight, we moved to Nottingham. And so I spent my formative years in Nottingham. And how I got interested in all this was there was a trad jazz boom in the 1950s in England. Bands like Ken Collier and Chris Barber and Mick Mulligan, and Chris Barber had Ottilie Patterson as a singer with his band. I remember she sang Weeping Willow Blues and Nobody Knows When You're Down and Out by Bessie Smith. I heard that before I heard Bessie Smith. And Mick Mulligan had a man called George Melly who sang with him. So I originally got interested in jazz. I didn't know very much about the blues. But then I've always had the sort of mind that likes to sort of, you know, catalog everything and know where everything is. And in the late 40s and early 50s, this was before there were any LP microgroove records, a number of small companies were reissuing 78 records in England. There was a company called Tempo, a label called Tempo, one called Jazz Collector. And I was buying these, and I started making a list of all the Jazz Collector. I mean, I bought Jazz Collector L20, Ma Rainey, So Soon This Morning, and Don't Fish in My... I was looking at the wrong one. Ma Rainey, C.C. Rider, and Jealous Hearted Blues on L20. And then there was a very exciting piano record by J.Bo Williams on... which one was that? Dug out the list, which I started making in 1955. J.Bo Williams, Jab Blues and Praxity Blues on L51. And so, you know, I started compiling these lists. Now, there wasn't a full discography of jazz, let alone of blues. There was a thing called Jazz Discography by Albert McCarthy and Dave Carey, which had got about as far as L, and then it sort of petered out. But then, of course, I got interested in looking at the original records, the original issues, and doing discography, not on the reissues, but on the original issues. And then I was also interested in buying records that hadn't been reissued. There was a wonderful magazine called Vintage Jazz Mart, produced by a man called Trevor Benwell, who was an air traffic controller at London Airport, but a wonderful jazz sort of collector. And he put out this magazine. It came on the 5th of every month, and they had a series of lists of records. And normally, records were auctions, so you put in a bid, you know, and the prices were not great at that stage. You know, you can get a Sleepy Joe Nash stage for about 15 shillings, which is sort of about $2 or something of that nature. And so I started buying records. And I then went up to Oxford to study mathematics. And I didn't have much money, of course. So what I was doing was buying records often from the States. And then I bought an early tape recorder, Telefunken tape recorder, in about 1957 or so, and I'd record them and then sell them. Sometimes made a slight profit, but the main thing was I had the records there. I had the music there. The records of American, details of the recordings of American record companies, some of them were available. There was a wonderful lady called Helen Shimura at Columbia Records, and she'd had sort of mimeographed out, ronioed out, the complete matrix listings and the complete issue listings of all the records on Columbia and OK in the 20s and 30s. And these had come a little bit before my time, but they'd gone to a couple of English collectors called Bert Wyatt and Derek Collar, and they lend them to me, and I type them out. But then the important thing, of course, is getting together with John Goderich, because we formed a very important team. The Decca Record Company is interesting. In 1934, just as America was coming out of the recession, the English record company called Decca formed an American sort of branch, and they were putting out records at 35 cents, because you had to do that to sell them. Back in the 20s, 75 cents had been the normal price for most records. There were dime store records for 35 cents, things like that. But and they started a series. The records put out for the, as it was called then, the Negro market, usually put out in special series. They were called race series, for the race. And Decca started a race series in 1934 with a number 7,000. It had gotten 7,910, so I think 910 in issues, by the time it finished in the early 40s. And I was trying to make a complete list of these, and there were no company files we could get to there. So I advertised in Vintage Jazz Mart, for information, and at the same time, John Goderich had advertised. And so we got together and we pooled our resources. And John was interesting. I mean, he was born, I think, about 1927. His mother was a doctor in Swansea in South Wales, and he ran off to sea when he was about 15, joined the Merchant Navy. This was towards the end of the Second World War. And then when he left the Navy, he came and he worked as a docker, what you'd call a longshoreman, on the Swansea docks. And then he not naturally, he buggered a bit up his back. He injured his back, and he was working in the office then. So I was about, 1959, I think, when we got together. I was about 20, and he was about 32. And we just pooled all our resources. We borrowed the information from which Helen Shimura had circulated. And John typed out some of it, and I typed out some of it. And we made copies for each other. I was studying mathematics, and you don't have to work very hard. You don't have to work very many hours in mathematics. If you're doing science, you have to go to all the labs. If you're doing English or history, you have to write essays every week. In mathematics, you just solve a few problems, do a few sums. So I had plenty of time for... I used to spend some time going on the river at Oxford, as students do there, but plenty of time for typing out all these lists and so on. And John and I, in fact, didn't meet. We must have started working together, I think, about 59. We didn't meet until 2 or 3 years later. I, by that time, had moved to Edinburgh. I finished my time at Oxford, and I went to Edinburgh. Working at I was employed as a research fellow in statistical linguistics, trying to apply statistical methods to linguistics. And we actually met in Dobell's record shop at 77 Charing Cross Road, which is the sort of the centre of record buying in England. I think about 1961 or so. The interesting thing was, when we first got together, John had made a list of, let me just get it here, he made a list, a rough guide to blues discographies appearing in jazz magazines, and he sent it to me. John didn't have a typewriter, but I did, and so I typed it up and put, by John Goderich, and he sent it into Trevor Benwell for Vintage Jazz Mart. They had a few little tiny articles at the beginning. It was called Margin Notes, But then John put "and Bob Dixon" on as well, since all I did was type it up at that stage. But then, you know, we started working, and also the other 20 of these margin notes appeared. We had indexed the label listings, which had appeared in jazz magazines, indexed the traditional swing and modern jazz discography appearing in jazz magazines, and, the interesting thing was, interesting indexed to articles on blues singers, which had appeared in jazz magazines. And Paul Oliver, who you know, is going to feature in your book, is the most amazing man, a sort of hero of mine, but also a very close friend. We did a complete listing of all the articles by Paul Oliver, which had appeared in magazines from 1954 up till 1958. And then we also had articles by Bob Kirsten, who's the bottom of the same page, I see. So he's also somebody in your book. Paul Oliver played a very important role. I mean, I was writing to him about discography, and he said, well, come up and spend the weekend with us. He was at that time just an art teacher at a high school in London before he was a drawing master, as it were. And I went and spent the weekend with him. That was just before his first book, Blues for This Morning, came out. This was in January 1960. His book came out in April 1960. And in the summer of 1960, he got a United States fellowship to actually go to the States and go to the southern states and try and find some of the old blues singers, new blues singers, and record them and so on. But he had no money to do any recordings. So I started a thing called a blues recording fund, I think it was called something like that. And people sent in £3, which was about $6 or so, as a sort of loan for this. And we got a few hundred dollars and enabled Paul to record people like some of the people down south, like Wade Walton and from Brother Montgomery in Chicago and things like that. And these were issued on little records, small specialized record labels in England. And we were able to pay the money back. The people lent £3 and I paid back £3.50. About 2 years later, something like that.
You're listening to Blues Before Sunrise and our interview with Robert M.W. Dixon, who compiled the pre-war blues discography, Blues and Gospel Records, 1890 to 1943. And now, back to our interview.
But John Godrich and I, we were trying to be absolutely systematic. And how do you know? I mean, if you want to get all the records by someone like, say, Big Bill Broomsey, how do you know when you've got them all? And they recorded all over the place, not from different labels and so on. So we decided the only thing we could do was to try and make a complete listing of all the records on every one of the appropriate labels and series.
Oh, my God.
And that way. So I'd say we were working on the Decca one. For the Bacalian 1000 and Brunswick 7000, very important records labels in the late 20s, there were some file cards which we sent around, and we would lend those, and I typed out all the information on the file cards. I'd say for the Columbia and OK, all the information had been circulated, that was OK. For Paramount, quite a few people had worked on it. Michael Wyler had a series of articles in Jazz Monthly, going through all the things, about 1,100 something like that, issues on Paramount. No company files had survived there. And then a man called Max Rayner worked on it later. And all of these companies I just mentioned had special race series. So all you had to do was get everything in the Columbia 1300 or 1400 series and everything in the Paramount series, But Victor and Bluebird, was a major label, I suppose, in some ways, didn't have a special series. Well, they had a couple of very short special series, but most of the time the records were issued in the general series. So what you had to do was make an overall listing of everything in the general series, all the pop and country, western, hillbilly, and blues. But the blues records were issued in batches, and so you get sort of six a month or something like that. So you'd identify the batches of blues records, and then get information in more detail than those. In the 20s, there were quite a number of smaller labels. There was a label called Herwin, run by a couple of brothers in St. Louis, I think. beautiful label. They had about, you know, six issues or something like that. So we had to cover those as well. But, you know, we were building up all our files. In those days, of course, there was no... Well, photocopying, I think, existed, but it was, you know, about sort of three photocopies in England or something like that. So everything was typed out with carbon paper. And if you made a mistake, of course, you had to rub it out on you know, with... probably did four copies on each of the copies, so you didn't make mistakes as you were typing them. So I had a copy, and John had a copy, and then we'd sort the other copies. Paul Oliver was very helpful and very close to us. And then in 1961, Brian Rust published the first edition of his jazz discography from 1897 to 1931. Later on, he did a second volume from 31 to 42, and then he combined them all. There's been a number of editions of it, but this was the first one. He had included some blues singers who had jazz accompaniments. But in September 1961, I just moved to this job in Edinburgh, and I came down to London to do some course on the crazy programming system Fortran they had at the time, at IBM. And Paul said, you know, John and I were doing all this discography just for our own benefit. You know, we each had other things to do. It's just sort of a hobby. And Paul said, why don't you do, you two, get together and do a blues discography like Brian's jazz discography? We went around to see Brian. He said, yes, he would publish it. His publishing consisted of typing out the material on paper masters, and then printing them, and they did about 1,000 copies, and then they were worn out, sort of thing, you know. But what we hadn't got a lot of information, decent information. We obviously had the outline information, but not all the matrix numbers and recording dates for some of the Victor and Bluebird stuff. And these were in the files of the HMV company in Hayes, Middlesex, quite close to where Brian lived. And Brian has an eidetic memory, so he can just look at a page and memorize it, and then go home and write it all down. So I send Brian a list of all the information that we need. You know, we have a certain amount of it. But, you know, and a number of discographies have been published of individual artists in various magazines, and of course we were using everything that we could possibly find. So he went round to Hayes and got the extra information, put it in his head, came home, wrote it down. So we were able to get a pretty complete you know, listing then. Now, I went to this new job in Edinburgh in July 1961, and then Paul said, let's start doing this in September, so I started doing it immediately. And what we did it by labels. So I did everything on the Victor and Bluebird, the RCA Recording Company of America labels from when it started, about sort of 27 up until 42, which was our cut-off date. And then I did everything on Columbia and OK. So what we had was that we had a page for every artist, and then for the complete discography, which means that you give the date of recording, you give the artist's name, of course, and who'd always be a singer for blues, and what they're accompanying themselves on, if anything, all the other accompaniments, the date and the place. We also put the day of the week in. When people said that it's irrelevant, I don't think it's irrelevant at all. You know, it's interesting to know whether something was recorded on a weekday or a Saturday or Sunday. I mean, lots of artists would have various commitments at different times, and so I think that's an important thing anyway. It doesn't take up any extra space.
Well, of course, you have a matrix. I can tell you that I do programs of pre-war things done on Sunday, and we just go through the book and see what we can find.
Yeah. Oh, do you? How wonderful. Yes. That's terrific. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm glad. A number of people have said, you cut that out. That's ridiculous. You know. So I'm glad it's useful. Yeah. And then, of course, you have to have the matrix number, which is the consecutive number recorded, allocated by the record company for all their recordings. Some companies would have special series for different cities. So the regular series would be for New York, usually, and then they might have a series with C prefixed for Chicago. And then, of course, a lot of the companies went down south. And they'd spend a couple of months, and they go to Atlanta, and then they go to Memphis, and then New Orleans, and then Houston, or something like that, or Dallas. And they'd put MEM in front of the Memphis ones, and ATL in front of the Atlanta ones, and LO in front of the New Orleans ones, and so on. And then you have to have a take number, because in the 20s they would normally make two or three takes of each title, and they'd play them back and try and work out, you know, which was the best one. And sometimes one take would be issued on one label, and another take on another label, or another tape on the reissue. And then you had to have all the issue numbers. And sometimes things were issued on a number of different labels. I mean, the Jeanette Company in Richmond, based upon Richmond, Indiana, I think, wasn't it, it was a sort of furniture company that started doing records, and they did some of the finest records by black artists. But it was a very racist place. That they could hardly stay the night in Richmond. I think they'd have to go to Chicago or from somewhere else and get on the next train back or something like that. But they would issue something. I mean, Sam Collins, for instance, was issued on Jeanette under his real name. One of the things that really blew my mind, you know, I was, nowadays everything's available on CDs and before that on LPs. But in those days, the only way you could get Sam Collins was to actually buy a record of his. And I remember the first one I bought, I got it, you know, sent across from the States. What was it called? No, I've got it written down here somewhere. It was about 1960 I got it or something like that. But anyway, it was fine where it is. Yeah, that's it, yeah. It was Jeanette 6167, the Jailhouse Blues and Riverside Blues by Sam Collins, recorded in Richmond, Indiana, on Monday the 25th of April, 1927. And, you know, this is a completely different thing I've ever heard before. It's the most beautiful moment to remember that. But, of course, he recorded. Jeanette would issue their records on other cheaper labels, sold in the chain stores. And so he was, some coins was called Big Boy Woods on the Bell label, Jim Foster on Champion, Silvertone on Superior, and Jelly Roll Hunter on Supertone. And we had to sort of sort out all this duplication. Normally they didn't change the actual names of the tunes, but still, you know, that was quite a big thing to do.
You're listening to Blues Before Sunrise in our interview with Robert M.W. Dixon, who compiled the pre-war blues discography, Blues and Gospel Records, 1890 to 1943. And now, back to our interview.
How did you come to realize that all these pseudonyms were being used, and they were various, budget labels and things, but they were the same artist? When did you come to realize this?
Well, we weren't the first. People had been working on this for 10 years before us, and so there was a certain amount. But, you know, it was known that this happened, and so it was just a case of trying to get. And some of these chain store labels as well. I mean, they were pressed on inferior shellac, and they were sold in sort of homes where they probably would be not so well treated as a 75 cent records. So the copies of them are pretty rare. Well, what we did, you know, we had an incredible network of correspondents in England and Europe and in the States, of course, and we just put together all the information that we had. But sometimes, working out what the pseudonyms were, well, you could do it to a certain extent by listening to them. In gospel recordings, there were three sorts of gospel recordings. Basically, there was the guitar evangelists like Ed Claiborne and things like that. There were the down-home preachers like the Reverend Gates and the Reverend McGee, and there were the quartets, the gospel quartets. And people down south, the African Americans who were religious, they would only buy religious records. They wouldn't buy any blues records. And, you know, they would say this is the work of the devil and so on. But quite a number of quartets would record gospel records and also record secular records as well, secular tunes. But they would use a different name for it. So one of my favorite groups is the Birmingham Jubilee Singers. And they would record tunes like Every Time I Feel the Spirit and Walk in Jerusalem Just Like John. But then they also recorded things like "How Come You Do Me Like You Do" and "Toot Toot Dixie Bounce," and they would use the label the name Birmingham Quartet or Mobile, I suppose, isn't it? Mobile. But one only has to listen to the records to realize it's the same group. But of course, you've got to sort of check these things up. And so once you started looking at the discography, "Every Time I Feel the Spirit" and "How Come You Do" were recorded on the same day, Friday the 5th of November 1926, in the same place, Atlantic Georgia, by the Columbia Phonograph Company. So you know, so you can see they recorded a couple of religious ones and a couple of secular ones. And you know, it's the same session, so you can tell that. Well, one of the things which I think I was the first person to work out was that Blind Nemeth Jefferson was a blues singer and itinerant guitar picking. He's standing on the street corner in Dallas, and then he'd go up to north and record for Paramount. And most of his records were secular, highly secular. But a couple, there were a couple of records put out by Deacon L.J. Bates. And I listened to these, and I thought, that's Blind Nemeth Jefferson. Of course, the L.J., Lemon Jefferson, Deacon L.J. Bates. But then, looking at the actual discographical details, Black Snake Dream and Hot Dogs by Lemon Jefferson were given matrix numbers 4577 and 4578. The next matrix number is He Arose from the Dead, issued by Deacon L.J. Bates. The matrix numbers are actually on the record, you see, so in many cases, not all, but for Paramount they were. So discographically, obviously, you know, it's the same person coming from the same session. You've got to be very careful about having oral identifications, but there are a lot of people who say, oh, I'm certain that this pianist on this is the same as the pianist on that, and then someone else will say exactly the opposite, you know, so you really do need to get proper checking from things like this.
Isn't it interesting that his first records were the religious records?
Well, no, his first records weren't religious. No, these came quite late, I think.
Okay.
Let me just have a look at the book. Maybe they were. I don't know. You probably do more recently than me.
Yeah, I just thought it was real interesting that, you know, he was this heavy hitter bluesman and.
Yes, well, you're right, actually. Yes, I've forgotten that. Yeah. So the first two were Deacon L.J. Bates, and then the Blind Lemon Jeffersons were done, looks like a couple of months later. Yeah. Yeah, how interesting. And so they, well, I mean, you know, I mean, I suppose people down south would know Blind Lemeth Jefferson was a blues singer, so they couldn't use that name. So the first ones were Bates, yeah.
Can I ask a couple of questions about the specific labels?
Yeah.
Okay. You talked about working on Victor and Bluebird. Where did the bulk of the information come about Columbia and OK? Were there company records that still existed?
For Columbia and OK, there was this wonderful lady called Helen Chimura, H-E-L-E-N-E, probably with an accent, one of the E's, C-H-M-U-R-A, who worked in, you know, some sort of documentary department of the Columbia Record Company. Before they were all bought up by whatever, you know, Japanese companies more than recently or something like that, isn't it? And she had typed out a complete list of all the recordings, but by matrix number, and also all the issues on the race series, and circulated these in the early 50s. And there were a couple of collectors a bit older than us, Derek Collar and Bert Wyatt in England, who got these. And they lend them to us, and then we type them out. So that was, there was no difficulty about that whatsoever, except that, well, I mean, we had the matrix and take numbers, but the accompaniments and so on had to be worked out. You know, it wasn't all done, but a lot of it was done then.
How about Brunswick? Where was the information from that one?
Well, the Brunswick 7000 series. And the Bacalian 1000 series, which was, I mean, the company started out separately, but they sort of, merged in the late 60s. There was a card file of that, and that was lent to me. So I remember about in January 1960, I spent about, you know, 6 hours a day just typing out the whole of that. And there were also interesting comments like well, I'm the Bekele one. Bekele 1217, Reverend A.J. Nixon's congregation. The matrix numbers are given in the Fathers 2479, 2480 on the cards. And Begin a New Life on Christmas Day, Part 1, Begin a New Life on Christmas Day, Part 2. And then there's dates given. It's a bit obscure exactly what the dates are. It's 2811101, which probably was the first of the first of November and 1928. And that, I think, was when the information was sort of typed up in the head office, which may be a couple of weeks later than being recorded. Then the next entry says a midnight round of Bullfiddle Rag Barrel House Dance, and it says cancelled. And the next one says a midnight round of Shake Your Shimmy and Bullfiddle Rag, so they changed one of the titles. And that was, it says apparently no advice on card, it wasn't used. And then it says 1218, the Midnight Rounders, Shake Your Shimmy. The other side is Albert Williams' Gut Bucket 5, Crying My Blues Away. So they had three goes at what they were going to put on 1218. Either Midnight Rounders, Bullfiddle Rag and Barrel House Blues, or the Midnight Rounders, Shake Your Shimmy and Bullfiddle Rag. And eventually that number came out with only one side by the Midnight Rounders. Shake Your Shimmy, and the other side, Cry My Blues Away by Albert Wynne, who's got Bucket 5. So, you know, you can see exactly in this way, you know, the mechanism of what they were doing back then in 1928.
That's fascinating, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
You're listening to Blues Before Sunrise in our interview with Robert M.W. Dixon, who compiled the pre-war blues discography, Blues and Gospel Records, 1890 to 1943. And now, back to our interview.
For those, the Columbia and OK, and Bacalian and Brunswick, and also the other Bacalian one that came out, the 2500 series in the 30s. A lot of these early series sort of finished the beginning of the Depression, and there was virtually no recording in 32 and 33, and then 34 things started up again. We had some reasonable information, but we still had to work out all the accompaniments, you know, Loving Sam from Down in Band, Sam Third, accompanied by piano. Was it his own piano, or was it Caco Davenport on piano? In fact, it gives you the composer credits as well. You know, this is Brunswick 7090, Loving Sam from Down in Band, Sam Third, accompanied by piano. And one is Get Your Mind On It by Third and Davenport. The other one is Doodle It Back by Davenport. So one wonders, aha, maybe it was Caco Davenport coming on piano. Let me just look up it in the book and see exactly what was decided for that. Probably Caco Davenport piano and temporary guitar. You see the actual information on the card didn't mention guitar, but you can hear the guitar on it, and you know it's probably Caco Davenport piano, but you can't be certain of it. I don't think Loving Sam played anything himself, actually. He's just a singer. But then for Brunswick and Victor, we had to sort of, I say, outline of all the issues, which is quite a big thing, and then hone in on those blocks of there'd be sort of four or five jazz, and then there'd be four or five blues, and then there'd be sort of four or five country western, and then there'd be sort of, you know, 10 pop each month or something like that, so you can identify the groups. But then we had to do that.
You had the list of a specific labels. Did you have specific collectors, for instance, who handled the Paramount labels?
Well, the Paramount label, as I said, there'd been a listing by Mike Weiler in Jazz Monthly in the late 50s, and so we were able to build on that. But what we did was, when we were writing this compiling Blues and Gospel Records, which we started in September 1961, as I say, we produced about 10 files, one for each of the companies, and then the major companies, and one for each of the minor companies, and then we circulated that to seven collectors, I think, and each of them went through the whole of every file. I mean, the people we sent them to were obviously Paul Oliver and Bert White and Derek Collar and a wonderful friend, Francis Smith, who later became Francis Wilford Smith, who was one of the most a really exotic character, and he's a very enthusiastic collector. He's also a very well known cartoonist, under the name Smilby. He used to draw cartoons for Playboy every month or so, and kept him enough money to buy lots of records.
I'll bet, yeah.
Yeah. But another important thing, which I sort of haven't mentioned, is that from about 1960 onwards, these blues singers started being rediscovered in America. I mean, you know, some of them were actually living in sort of obscurity, like Mississippi John Hurt was living in Avalon, but he'd written a song called Avalon Blues, and so you just go down to Avalon, and one of the people on your in your book, I think it was Dick Waterman, wasn't it, who went and found him, I think, something like that. But other people were just playing for the in the jukeboxes in the juke joints of Chicago, and they were brought across to England. And Francis Smith had this wonderful manor house down in Sussex, about an hour south above London, it was 1,560 houses, something like that. And he used to invite them down for the weekends, and I used to go as well. And so we had Speckled Red and Roosevelt Sykes and Little Brother Montgomery. And little Brother Montgomery came up to Nottingham, I was at Oxford, but I was still going home for the vacation, things like that. And the impresario there, Bill Cannell, asked me if I sort of meet him at the station and take him to the gig and take him back and put on a train back to London afterwards and so on. You know, I was growing up in a very very middle class white English household. I suppose not too different from middle class white American households at the time. And my father was principal of a technical college, and I said to my mother, "Look, I'm looking after little brother Montgomery. Can I come home for him? Can I bring him home for an hour or two?" She said, "Well, better not. I don't think your father would like it," she said. So I looked off elsewhere. But it was wonderful. I remember taking Speckled Red. In fact, there was a photographer called Valerie Wilmer, who's made quite a name for herself, I think, at that time and since. Taking photographs of jazz artists and things like that. And Barry Wilman and I both called on Speckled Red. We took him out one afternoon. We took him to the Tower of London, where you could see the crown jewels and where all the people had their heads chopped off. Henry VIII said, "I won't have my lunch until that man's head rolls," and things like that. And there was someone outside, one of these Houdini-type people. He'd tie himself up in a sack, and someone would tie him up in chains and things like that, and he'd get out of these, you know. And Speckled Red was tickled pink by this, and I had to stop him sort of giving all his money away. I said, £5 is enough. I don't think you need to give £20. So I got to know these people. As I say, going back, it'd be good if you could edit these and put them in some sort of much more logical order, probably. I went to Edinburgh in September. I've been just doing mathematics. I started doing a PhD at Oxford, and then I decided that mathematics was too arbitrary. You made up your own axioms and you saw what followed from that. But linguistics, you take the material in real languages, and you can't change that, and then you really have to analyze it. So I went as a research fellow in statistical linguistics. What I was doing was be applying statistical methods to linguistic data. And I was doing that all day, and then in the evenings I'd be typing up. I first of all did a complete file for Columbia and then I did a complete file for Victor and Bluebird, and I was halfway through the Decca one by about Christmas, and sending them to John Gorlitch and these other seven people who were looking at them and giving us comments and so on. And then linguistics suddenly gripped me so much, I embarked on an incredible love affair with it. I said to John, "I haven't got the time to do this anymore." He said, "Okay, well, I'll take over." So John did the rest. So John did about 70% of them. Well, it was all based upon our joint work over the years. And then after we'd got the individual files, one for each label, if an artist occurred in several, these had to be collated. So I say Big Bill Brunsley was in four different labels, and so you'd have to collate those. And then we sent him down to Brian Rust in about 1963, I think, and he typed the whole lot up. This was no computers in those days, and on these paper matrices, and the book came out in 1964, But meanwhile, yeah, it was a reasonably good listing, but obviously there were many more things that could come, and a lot of people we hadn't been in touch with. And so a huge number of collectors read it. They were wonderful in sending us in corrections and comments and further information and so on. So John had a regular column called "I Believe I'll Make a Change," which was the blues recorded by about Peter Wheatstraw, I think, and about four or five other people in the middle 30s. And then we had a second edition in 1969, I think it was, and that was published by Storyville Publications, again a very small company. Well, I mean, Primrose was just Primrose, but Storyville Publications put out a regular magazine. It was run by a man called Laurie Wright, a regular magazine called Storyville. And then after Edinburgh, I went to Australia and did some field work up on the disappearing Aboriginal languages of North East Queensland. And then I went back to be a lecturer in linguistics at University College London. And then I spent a year in America at Harvard, 1968-1969. And then in 1970, I moved to Australia for good, to the Australian National University in Canberra, as the first professor of the chair of the linguistics department there. And John Godrich was getting increasingly, he had a very bad back and his health was very poor. He said, "Look, I can't carry on with this. Who should we get to do it? I said, "Well, I'll do it. I'll take over." He said, "I thought you were going to a new job in Australia." I said, no, I'm happy to do that." So really from 1970 onwards, I was thinking, so the first edition was actually by Benedict and Godrich, but that was alphabetical order. The second one was by, that was 64. The second one, 69, was by Godrich and Dixon, because he did most of it. And then we brought out another one, which the next one came out when about 82, I think. That was also done by Storyville, and so that was Dixon and Godrich. But say people were sending in information all the time. You've got to be very careful, because a lot of people, for them, they can't read labels properly, or they think something's a take number, it's not a take number, it's some other sort of number. But we would know from experience with the records and so on. And all identifications are always, very fraught. I mean, it's obviously good to have this information, but you've got to put it with other things as well. And we also added lots of information on the Library of Congress records, made by John Lomax and people like that going around the South, which were not for commercial issue. Some of them have been issued since, but they... And we also extended the coverage for the third edition to 1943, it started in 1902 because, as far as we knew, that was the first, genuine recording by a, an African American group in the sort of, African American style, the Dinwiddie Colored Quartet. Then we stopped in 1942 because there was a recording ban, the Petrillo ban, the American Musicians Union, I think, were fed up with the jukeboxes taking over from live performance and so on. So there was a ban for a couple of years. And also the music styles and then the methods of recording and things like that changed completely after the war. So we called a ban in 1942. But in fact, there were some recordings made by people like, non-union musicians, I suppose, for small companies, like especially gospel singers, things like that. And so we added the stuff in 1943. And then we were always hoping that we would get it published by a proper commercial publisher. And the University of Illinois Press had approached me when I was there in about 69 and said, we'd like to. I said, "Well, we've just got an edition coming out with the Storyville publications in England now, but, I'll let you keep you in mind later on." So when we were planning the third edition a few years later, I got in touch with Illinois, but it was very hard to get a reply out of them, and I think the person who talked to me had moved on, so they never got anything out of them. So Storyville produced the third edition. And then for the fourth edition, we got Oxford University Press to do it, which was obviously much better from our point of view. And John wasn't playing a very active role, but I was with him, who was talking to him about everything and showing him everything, and he was checking everything and giving ideas and so on. Howard Rye, who's a bit younger than us, John's about 12 years older than me. I think Howard's probably about 12 years younger than me. Howard Rye was working for Laurie Wright, and he was... He typed out the whole of the third edition, and he's a tremendous jazz expert, and he's like a sort of a co-author. So we invited him to join us as co-author for the fourth edition. And then John Coverage died, and it, just as a, you know, it was being planned, and then he'd approved the number of changes we were making, but he died, I think, in about 1991, or something like that. He just had bad health, he sort of collapsed. He was only about 64 or something of that nature, I think. And but what we did for the fourth edition is, up until then, we'd only recorded records by, you know, if I can use black rock, African Americans, but easier to say, by black artists for a black audience. And we'd missed out on people like the Tuskegee Quartets and the Pace Jubilee Singers and things like that. And Doug Seroff, who's a, you know, collector and dealer and things like that in Nashville, Tennessee, he kept on writing and saying, you've got to put these people in, you know, it's important to put them in. I mean, they're, and so, you know, it seemed a reasonable thing. John wasn't at all happy about this, but he approved of it, and Howard wasn't very happy either. But, you know, it's just not the sort of music that we particularly like ourselves, I suppose. But, you know, we felt that we got happier about it as time went on, and Doug was persuasive in extreme. And so that was the big addition for the fourth edition.
You're listening to Blues Before Sunrise and our interview with Robert M.W. Dixon, who compiled the pre-war blues discography, Blues and Gospel Records, 1890 to 1943. And now, back to our interview.
With the fourth edition, and it seems like with the addition of Howard Rye, that you have a couple of cross-references in the back that didn't exist in earlier copies. Were you involved in that, or was that something that Howard Rye did on his own, or how did that work?
What do you mean, cross-references? You mean the indexes?
Yeah, the index to titles.
Howard Rye did all that, and he did it mechanically, and I said, can't you do it? Because, I mean, the whole thing, of course, was done on the computer for the fourth edition. Couldn't you do it by you know, all these indexing programs? And Howard said, no, those don't work, they're more bothered than worth, and so he did it all. No, we'd always... wanted that, but it was sort of Howard's, I suppose, idea, and Howard did that, so we were delighted to do that. See, one criticism people have given is that we don't give the the composers for the tunes. Well, we if we wanted to do that, we should have done it when we started, I suppose, because, I mean, we do have the composer details for some, but not for others. But to do it now would be such a huge job. You know, we'd have to go right back for every single thing, and, you know, when collectors sent in information about records in their collection, they didn't give that because they didn't think we wanted it. We'd have to go back again. So to do that completely would be a huge job. It'd also make the book a lot bigger, I suppose. Every entry would take two lines instead of one line. But I agree, in principle, it should be done.
I don't know if it would serve a purpose or not, but perhaps there should be some indicator of whether it was an acoustic recording or an electronic recording. Certainly after a certain...
Well, you can sort of tell, in as much as I think we probably say in the introduction, when we talk about all the various record companies, that I mean, basically, I think anything from sometime in 1925 onwards for the Cranberry and OK, and then Victor was it there.
Right.
Recording. The other ones, you know, Paramount would follow a bit later. There's a story that some company said electrical recording, when all they had was an electric light in the studio to help the performer to see the acoustic horn or something like that, you know. But we wouldn't want to do that for every, but perhaps if we hadn't said it properly, perhaps in the next edition, we should say everything up to a certain number is acoustic, everything after a certain number is electric.
How many copies through the various editions, what, four editions now, how many copies all told do you think were pressed and sold?
Well, I can tell you, because obviously we like to document ourselves as well. If you look in the introduction to the fourth edition, page Roman 13, it says it ran to three printings, the first edition, in spring and autumn 64. Brian Rust did 500, and then he did another 250, and then he did about 350, and then the paper masters, wouldn't print anymore. So the first one, we had 1,100 copies. And then the interesting thing was, well, I did it a bit later then. The second edition was published in the summer of 69, and there was 2,000 copies altogether. The third edition was published in October 82, and the initial printing of 1,500 copies and another 500 copies. And so we had 1,100 for the first and 2,000 for the second and 2,000 for the third. Oxford University Press, for the fourth edition, I think they did about something like 1,300 or 1,400 copies, maybe. I think a bit less than 1,500. And then they did a reprint of another 500. So some were, altogether, they did, you know, a bit less than 2,000. And the man from Oxford University Press, Bruce Phillips, who was the music book editor in Oxford, said when he took it, well, he agreed with us that this should be kept in print forever. I mean, it doesn't sell a huge number, but it has a very sort of steady sale. But then Oxford University Press, a few years ago, wrote and said, you know, your book sold quite well, but it's going to go out of print now. Now, this was just the same time that Tony Russell's country music discography was being published. Now, it's been published by European American. And it seemed funny. I mean, his was sort of based upon ours in some way. I mean, the whole sort of, you know, way of doing it and a lot of cross-references. So we eventually, by this time, Bruce Phillips had retired. And music books were being done through OUP in New York, not through the head office in or the home office in Oxford. And so the New York office agreed that they would reprint it. So it's now comes from them. But it's very, Howard Wright gets very annoyed about this because it's almost impossible to buy it as far as we can see. People often try and buy it, and people say it's not available. They sell about 30 copies a year. We get a minuscule royalty on it, but it's still is available somehow from OUP New York. Now, there's one very important thing. There's one very important difference between Brian Rust's jazz records and our blues and gospel records. Brian Rust lists everything which he identifies as being a jazz performer, whether it was by... Whereas in blues and gospel records, we only include records made by African-Americans. There were a few records which were issued by white performers, and they were put out in race series. And one of the things we've done over the years is to try and establish whether these were... Well, quite a number of records by African-American performers were put out in hillbilly series as well. You know, the Mississippi Sheiks, things like that. But God, I think they had some in the hillbilly series. But what we've tried to do is identify any record in a race series which was by a white person, by a white performer, and eliminate those. And so we usually have a note that, you know, that this person appeared in the race series, you know, they're actually a white performer. And it's interesting how, you know, I only sort of thought this through a few years ago, that we're absolutely color conscious, whereas Brian Rust isn't. He's just a conscious of the music. But if we have a fifth edition, we'd like to do that, although it's difficult to know exactly how to do it now. It might have to be electronic because of the way the world's going. But I suggested to Howard Wright that we should actually include all the, perhaps as an appendix or perhaps in the list itself, all full details of all the records in, you know, which were marketed as if they were African-American records, although they weren't by African-American artists.
Were there ever any paperbacks or soft covers? These were all hardcover books, right?
Yes. Well, one interesting thing which I wanted to mention was there used to be a thing, probably still, I suppose, called Books in Print, and published by Bowkers in New York. I suppose it's electronic now, but it used to be a hard copy thing. And I was once looking through it, because I've written quite a lot of books on linguistics and things like that. You know, if you get very depressed, you sort of look and see if your books are still in print or something like that, once every couple of years. And I suddenly saw that there was a Blues and Gospel Records published by somebody called Scholarly. And it was obviously a pirate edition, and it was this was $75, and at the time we were selling the third edition, we were selling for $35, something like that, you know. And when I looked in the index for Blues Books in Print, there were four companies which were called Scholarly Press or Scholarly something else. So I wrote to all four of them, and three of them wrote back and said, no, it wasn't us. So it was obviously the fourth one. And they just pirate edition. Brian Rust forgot to put copyright on the first edition. So I wrote to Books in Print and said, look, do you realize that you're including something on a book which is not officially illegal, it's totally immoral. And also it's a first edition, which was way out of date. And you know, $75 for the first edition, and you could buy the third edition for $35. And so Books in Print wrote to it was actually, the people were actually called Scholarly Press, St. Clair Shores, Michigan, USA, just from the point of view, I think. And they said, well, we haven't done anything wrong, you know, we haven't broken any laws, you know. But it was withdrawn, I think, quite soon after that. But no, there's never been a paperback edition. It's interesting, Oxford University Press are going to be issuing a paperback edition of Tony Russell's country music discography, because there's a lot of demand from universities, you know, courses on country music and things like that, and students go, oh, these books are so big that a paperback edition would hardly be wieldy. You know, you really need proper binding for it, I think. But no one's ever talked about a paperback edition of ours.
I know the post-war, the latest edition of the post-war blues thing is in paperback, and I just thought, my God, we haven't worn them out, but I've certainly given your books a beating, and I said, I have no faith at all that this thing is going to last more than a year or two.
True, yeah.
Wasn't there something that, when we spoke before, that you wanted to make sure we included?
Yes. Well, yeah. it's interesting, you know, that the discographies of American music have almost entirely been done by foreigners doing it in their spare time. And so the first great discography of jazz in the 30s was by a Frenchman called Hot Discography by Charles Delaunay, Delaunay, I think. And then there's our book, and Tony Russell, who's also, someone from Oxford, like Howard Reimer and myself, has got that one out. And quite a lot of people at American universities, you know, they've had big grants from the NSF and things like that to do this sort of thing, but they've never done it, whereas we've done it in our spare time. Besides linguistics, my main job is as a professor of linguistics. I've worked on the languages from northeast Queensland in Australia. I've just now moved to live in Cairns, which is the area. I mean, the languages I was working on in the 60s, and 70s, and 80s, I worked on five languages, and four of them are extinct. The last speakers that have gone, the other one just has two or three speakers. But the people are very interested to revive the languages, and from the materials which I got from there. Fathers and grandfathers, when they weren't still interested then, we're trying to have some revival projects on. I also worked I lived in a monolingual village in Fiji in the 80s and went to grammar of a language there. And I've also had about sort of seven field trips to Brazil, working on a language from the middle of the Amazonian jungle. And so I published quite a lot of books on linguistics and so on. And I've actually just completed, or just about to complete, a sort of scholarly autobiography. It's called I Am a Linguist, which hopefully will be published by Brill in the Netherlands. I've got to send them the final manuscript, and they'll get it reviewed and so on. But we might know by the time, before your book goes, you get published or something like that. But chapter four of that is on discography, and it talks about, the principle of the discography. What you do. A lot of the things I've been saying today are in, but there's more than there. In fact, I've got the chapter in front of me, and I've been, some of the things I've been giving you from that. But there's more besides. Anyone who wants to know a bit more of discography, and I also say how it ties in with my other interests as well, because my life isn't in watertight compartments. So some of the things I've done on linguistics, I've used some of the principles that I started, developed in discography, and applied them in other fields as well. So it all interrelates.
You're talking about this book, an autobiography. This is your latest book in a long string. How many linguistic books do you have at this point?
Oh, I've probably written about 20 books on linguistics, I would think. I think about 20 probably.
Yeah, I think I counted 18. And I probably didn't include some of the later ones. So,
well, I've got two books. I've got a three-volume book called Basic Linguistic Theory, which is sort of the culmination of what I've been doing. Just to know how to write grammars and a survey of what's in grammars, things like that. And the first two volumes are coming out next month from Oxford University Press. I make it 20. And then volume three I'm working on now.
You've been listening to our interview with blues discographer Robert M.W. Dixon, co-compiler of the pre-war blues discography, Blues and Gospel Records 1890 to 1943. We'll pause to identify the station, and then we're back with hour number four. ¶¶